and welcome to That's What She Said, the intersectional feminist podcast where we discuss current affairs and a badass woman from history.
Whoop whoop.
With me, Nina Attridge.
And me, Hannah Thacker.
And we are your hostesses.
Hosts?
I was going to say hostesses and then I was like, no, we're hosts.
We ain't.
We ain't. We hosts. Yeah. We hosts. Hosts and bitches. Oh, fuck. This is going to be one of those days.
It really is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. What have you been doing?
As we just discussed, not much. Off air, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
We had a conversation about... Well, we do things. We do have social lives, but we have to do a little value judgment at the start of every episode and decide what's worth you knowing and what isn't. Hannah decided it's not worth you knowing she had a sandwich yesterday.
Do you know what? I didn't even do that. It was just a funny joke.
it was a really funny joke.
Good.
I was supposed to go to a talk... by a sex blogger called...
You can't count things you were supposed to have done and then didn't do.
I'm going to include it anyway.
All right.
A sex blogger called Aloni that I didn't know anything about, but she was doing a free talk at Manchester SU. And I got a free ticket. And then I was too hungover to drive back from Chester because I'd been visiting my friend. Yeah. I also had to cancel a date as well, so... It all evens out.
Does it, though?
Somehow. What about you?
Like I said, I just went to the grand old city of Leicester.
Yes.
To see my friends from uni, because that's where I went to uni.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we had a little Galentine's weekend.
Oh, that's really cute.
It was very cute.
I was supposed to be doing something for Galentine's and then I was working. This is a lot of near misses of doing fun things. I also nearly bought a moon cup.
Oh, nearly?
Yeah, nearly.
Is it on the to-do list?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I actually do want to go first. It's kind of news. This is an interesting one.
Okay.
Because it affects who we are as people and the podcast.
All right.
You should look scared. So, I was on the Twitter the other day and I saw, you know, when a Twitter thread just blows up.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I had no idea that this was a thing. You know, you just like, something blows up. Are we doing the same thing?
I don't think so.
Why are you looking at me like we're doing
just
the same thing?
Just because I was just on Twitter today.
Because you'd heard of Twitter. She's looking at me like she knows something because she's like, yes, I was on Twitter.
No, I'm reeling from a thread in the back of my mind.
Okay. I'll just go ahead.
In the Twitter of my mind.
Oh, dear. I'm gonna go and then then you can pull all the faces you want. So, a few days ago, a guy on Twitter called Rhea Butcher, very famous, verified, lots of followers, absolutely no idea who he is.
He's got the blue tick.
Yeah, he's got the blue tick, but I had no idea who he was. So he shared a picture of Don Cheadle, who you will recognise. I didn't know his name, but he's an actor that's in... I knew him from Hotel Rwanda and Avengers Infinity War.
I have watched neither of these films.
You will recognise his face.
Okay.
Google his face. So it's a picture of him wearing a t-shirt that said protect trans kids on it. And the caption that Rhea Butcher put with the picture on his tweet was, and since we're talking about it, this is what an intersectional statement looks like. It does sound a bit weird anyway. I think before you delve into like the academics of it and the meaning behind the word intersectional, I think just saying something is an intersectional statement probably does sound a bit weird to most people, do you not think? Can a statement be intersectional anyway? It's kind of the hanging question of this.
Yeah, okay.
Because that would be really mean, actually, because if I asked you this and then you said the wrong answer and I was just about to be like, actually, no. But okay. So... this is basically a debate as to what we mean when we say intersectional and whether or not it means what we think it means. It's actually something I've discussed in seminars before. It's a term that's like not really used in academia because it's not got a very pinpointed definition, so you can't just kind of throw it around and expecting to know the meaning and assuming that everyone takes the same meaning from it. So anyway, a YouTuber called Kat Black, another very famous person, she's a YouTuber, speaker, illustrator and animator, really famous, I had not heard of her, So she quote tweeted it and did a thread about what intersectionality is that I think we would all benefit from hearing. So I'm going to read it to you if mm-hmm. that's okay. So this is Kat Black speaking now. I'm using her words. Okay, so real quick, I feel like I really need to explain intersectionality to white people because stuff like this, even though it's well-meaning, is getting on my nerves. It's really hard to see a black woman's work be misused over and over again by progressives slash well-meaning people, which sent fear into my heart because I was like, I think this is aimed at me, which kind of is. So Don Cheadle wearing a shirt that says protect trans kids is amazing and I support the hell out of it, but it is not intersectionality. That's not what that means. Within, I'd say, mostly white political spaces, it's very easy for people to confuse intersectionality with inclusion or being considerate for other identities. It's also easy to think it's all about a combination of identities, but it's not exactly that. Intersectionality was a term coined by a black woman named Kimberly Crenshaw, who is still on Twitter if you want to follow us, at Sandy Locke, I'm going to link her, in 1989. It's a term that she created in her paper she wrote for the Chicago Legal Forum. To summarise what she meant when she defined intersectionality, it was about how black women were erased in conversations about discrimination because the feminist movement and the civil rights movement focused largely on its most privileged members. So feminism, at the time, and arguably still, focused largely on white women's experiences with sexism, and the civil rights movement focused, at the time, and arguably still, focused on how black men experienced racism. So black women's experiences had to be measured against that. So you had cases where black women would sue a company for racial discrimination, and then you'd have the judge say that it was impossible for that to be true because they currently employed black people. The problem was the black people were all men. You still with me?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have cases where they'd sue the company for being sexist, but they'd say that was impossible because they currently employed several women. The problem being these women were all white. So the bones of intersectionality really has to do with the ways in which black women specifically have been ignored and dismissed because of the more mainstream view of what sexism and racism looks like. Now, this is the bit I put in bold because it's the most concise definition, I think, that we can take from this. So, intersectionality is about viewing discrimination outside the single axis view of discrimination, where individuals are only impacted by singular forms of discrimination, e.g. white women by sexism, black men by racism. It's an acknowledgement that sometimes these things intersect, that sometimes it's racism and sexism, sometimes it's just racism and sometimes it's just sexism, but it's about opening up to the idea that it isn't just one of these things. It can frequently be more than one. Which is why people often think it's about multiple identities, but really it's about multiple types of discrimination that can frequently inform each other. For example, women who are disabled are at a higher risk of sexual assault. When those women are black, that increases their risk of sexual assault. So in that situation, you have people who have multiple identities that face discriminations that often inform each other. Intersectionality can look like a person outside of one group advocating for another, but the optics of this situation aren't quite like that. It's allyship, and I think we should be celebrated, and I think that should be celebrated without misusing the work of a black woman and scholar. The meaning and use of intersectionality has expanded beyond black women's experiences, but it will always be about understanding the ways in which multiple types of discrimination inform each other. As a black woman who is trans, and thus at a higher risk of violence, it's important to me and my understanding of the world. Let's not warp it into a feel-good thing about a mixture of identities. Let's keep the definition and use it consistently because it is important.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts?
Well, you're stepping all over my ball for her.
Oh no! Oh no!
But only the intro. Which is actually quite cool that we've both come to intersectional feminism this episode.
Okay.
I actually don't know if that should take away from the actor's statement.
It's not about taking away from the actor's statement. It's about the guy that tweeted, this is what an intersectional statement looks like.
Yeah.
Because the guy, Don Cheadle, never said anything about intersectionality at all. Yeah. What is also problematic about it is the fact that they're sort of imposing, like, just because, in the fact that he's black and wearing a trans kids lives matter, I can't remember the exact wording. Trans kids.
Trans kids lives matter?
I can't remember.
Save trans kids' lives?
I don't know. It was something.
It's your story.
I know, but I can't remember the exact wording. Yeah, basically the problem being that he never said anything about intersectionality and they've just...
And someone else has imposed intersectionality on that statement.
And, just the problematic... I don't know, the notion of a statement being intersectional is quite... It's very bogged down in semantics. It's very difficult to actually define what a intersectional statement would be.
Can you sum up intersectional feminism into a single statement?
No, exactly.
Whether that be an action or a phrase or whatever. Yeah. I don't think so. However, we live in the age of Twitter and what is it now? 240 characters, right? 220?
Yeah.
It used to be 140 and that was really easy to remember. And now I'm just like, everyone's like, who the fuck knows?
just keep writing.
So, yeah, we live in this age of being very concise and punchy for social media and for likes and for retweets.
Mm.
So, I do think perhaps it's a misuse of the phrase.
Yeah.
But and it's also probably not the only one.
No, not at all. I don't want to say what the main takeaway of the argument would be because that is, again, reducing someone else's own academia into, like, the point of, like, academia isn't supposed to be tweetable. It's not supposed to be something you can summarize in a tweet. But obviously that was quite a long thread of tweets. And I think the main thing I take from it is that it's important to know where it came from as a term and just be continually challenging what we mean by it. Like, don't just throw around the term intersectional and say I'm an intersectional feminist and then do nothing to prove that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't just sort of rest on your laurels and say, well, I am an intersectional feminist, because that's, like, intersectionality is not like a state of identity or a state of being. It's a process of recognizing actions and doing things about them. I think it's more about action than labels in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting...
So, yeah, if you're going to use a piece of, like, theory or academia in your arguments or point making or whatever,
yeah,
you should probably know where it comes from so that you don't mislabel.
Yeah, I guess so. It's so complicated. Like, it's such a difficult term to pin down.
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah.
Well, I suppose the thing I come to is that we describe ourselves as an intersectional feminist
podcast.
That's
what I was going to yeah.
But for me, that means that we consider different identities, people separate from ourselves.
Mm. And I think...
Go on.
Yeah, well, I think in an ideal world, if feminism didn't have a long history of being exclusionary, is that a word?
Yeah,
exclusionary to non-white women.
Mm-hmm.
We should just be able to say feminist. But in the interests of... Is it more for our own benefit, then? Is it the interest of letting people know that we're not associating with that?
What do you mean?
Like, we don't want people to think we're those kind of feminists.
Oh, the fact that we have to say that we're intersectional feminists? Yeah. I think so, yeah. Yeah, because, there is a history and you can't get away from that. And... it is still not very welcoming to a lot of communities, a lot of people. You know, there are people who comment on how the women's marches across the world are very white, female dominated.
Okay.
And the same women won't show up to Black Lives Matter marches.
Hmm.
I don't go to any marches, so I can't really say anything.
I'm fine.
I'm fine.
I'm equal at least.
I just stay at home with my cat.
Oh.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, well, yeah. Have you got any more points?
Not really. It's just that it's a circular, like, it would be a circular argument because I don't know what the solution is, in the sense that I would like for us to be, to label ourselves as something other than just a feminist podcast, mm-hmm. because as a feminist podcast, we could very easily fall into a category of...
of two white girls chatting on, exactly. on the mic.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
we are.
Is what we are. This brings me on to one of my stories, which I was going to say till the end, but I'm going to go for it.
Okay.
Have you heard of Red Table Talk?
No.
So this is a sort of table discussion hosted by Jada Pinkett Smith.
Okay.
And with her daughter Willow Smith, her and Jada's mother, Adrienne Banfield, where they basically tackle issues surrounding race and identity.
Oh, you did? Did you show me one of these
yes,
ones?
Yes, I've shown you a previous video, which was...
It was about white feminism, wasn't it?
It was about feminism and womanism, which is another term that some people feel more comfortable with. And I think we both watched it and we were like, yes, this is brilliant. This is great. I can definitely like learn from this. However, is it our place to talk anything about it?
Yeah.
We decided at the time it wasn't.
Mm. I think it was also a very early episode and we were finding our feet and it was like, let's not throw ourselves in.
To be fair to ourselves, that is definitely true. However, I'm going to return to Red Table Talk because of a new panel discussion. I think I'm going to call it a panel discussion, even though they're sat around a table and not at a panel, that they had, because at the minute in America and Canada, it's Black History Month, which is in February.
Yeah.
Whereas in here, in the UK, where we are, Ireland and the Netherlands, it's in October.
Mm-hmm.
So we get two chances because we're all global world, aren't we? Like global world.
We're a global world.
We are. Yeah, stick it flat earthers.
Wow, this has taken a turn. Continue.
Well, I don't know. I'm just angry. So the title of their recent talk that they shared is Unpacking White Privilege.
Okay.
It's important, I think,
that
we do this as we are.
We really want to challenge ourselves today, don't we?
We're two visibly white women.
Mm.
Yes, we have different backgrounds and perhaps our ethnicities are surprising to some people, but that's aside from the point, because to the world, we are visibly white.
Yeah.
And that is that, as far as we go in terms of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So Jada Pinkett Smith, I hope I'm saying her name right, Jada?
I thought it was Jada.
That's true.
Also often
no, wrong. I think it is probably Jada.
Really?
That sounds more like, yeah, that sounds correct.
Okay.
Jada Pinkett Smith introduced this by picking out a phrase that was shared in the panel, which is, no woman is free until all women are free.
Mm-hmm.
And on this panel, as well as the family members that I just discussed, there was author and activist Rachel Cargill, actress Justina Machado, and writer Amy Newman. And they were representing three distinct ethnic groups.
Okay.
It's quite a long discussion, so go back and have a listen. It's good. Okay. It's very eye-opening and funny at points, which we like.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to pick up on two points. So Rachel Cargill raised an interesting idea that so-called white women say, I'm not privileged because I have this problem or I grew up this way. But her argument is that black women may have also have these problems and those experiences and that background, as well as having to live life as a black woman in a society that is constantly against them.
Mm-hmm.
So my takeaway from that is, rather than making excuses for why you're not privileged, you should accept why you are privileged. Yep. And by that acceptance, then turn around and open your ears and your minds to people who don't share the same privilege as you.
Exactly. And everyone can do that. Mm-hmm. Like, we were literally just talking about intersection. This is all very segueing so well.
I know,
but
right?
Everyone is privileged in some aspect of their identity.
Yep.
I mean, not everyone, some people are unlucky in the lottery of life.
Majority of people are privileged in one way.
Yeah, like in one aspect of their identity, you're probably, but it's not, one identity doesn't, trump another. Yeah, you have to just be open to see where your privilege is, like you just said.
Yeah. Mm. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Yeah. That is it.
Wherever it is, whether it's, like, if that's race, class, any of
your background, your platform,
able,
like your health,
mm,
can even be, yeah, a privilege.
Completely.
I'm going to go into another point, mm, by Amy Newman. She was, she is a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she spoke about an exercise she had recently done at a diversity workshop, where she had to write down the name, age, and race of her neighbours, friends, teachers, etc.
Okay.
And she found that despite herself being very intersectional, mm-hmm, as some may say, her list was dominated by white people.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting idea that brings... This is going to be a throwback.
Okay.
When we spoke about Charmadine Reed, who if you don't follow, please do, because she is a businesswoman worth following. She spoke about a friend she had, a white friend, because,
mm-hmm,
Charmadine Reed is black.
Yeah.
And, you know, when she went on her friend's social media, it was like a whitewash.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone her friend followed was white.
Yeah.
And she didn't really even share pictures of Charmadine, mm, on her socials. So I think that even some people may be like, well, I grew up in a town where there's pretty much only white people.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, the community I have isn't diverse in any way. You know, this also applies to other ethnicities, not just white people. But one thing we all have in our power at the minute is social media.
Yeah.
Our phones, our, yeah, laptops, whatever access you have. And a really simple way of opening up your minds to,
mm,
other identities,
yeah,
is follow some people.
Open up your world. It's, yeah, so easy.
Add some people to your newsfeed,
yeah,
who do not share the same identity and privilege,
yeah,
and race and ability, mm, whatever, as you.
I am so obsessed. Like, I've deleted my personal accounts for Twitter and Instagram off my phone, and now I only have the podcast ones.
All right.
And I just love our feeds. Like, because of the people we follow.
Yeah.
Our feeds are just brilliant. Like, they're so positive and, like, interesting. And I was like, why am I, like, looking at all this shit of my friends posting going on holiday when I could be, like, learning? Like, it's so good. Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah. It's such an easy way to... I feel like I've learned loads about other identities from social media, and I know loads of people have.
Yeah.
Like, no, I really like it for, like, with the podcast social media, because the algorithms, all of our suggested people. I've, like, found so many people I want to talk about on the podcast and stuff just from suggested people on our,
mm,
on our social medias, because it's just, like, it just snowballs and it's brilliant. I, yes, love it. I wish, yes, everyone could just scroll through our newsfeed, because, yeah, it's so good.
Well, that is a really, really simple way of, you know, making steps towards being, yeah, intersectional,
mm,
whether you are or you're not, or whether you hate that word or not.
Yeah.
Either. We're cool with it.
Yeah. You can, yeah, you can do it without it being labelled intersectional. You just live, yeah.
Yes. Right.
It's not about words, it's about deeds. says the podcast host.
This is doing stuff.
It's true, it is.
Yeah, mm, it is. All right. Have you got some news that isn't intersectional?
Oh my God.
I mean, it's all intersectional, but you know what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, I have an article for you from Refinery29.
Yep.
By Leila Haydrani. It's an article about a book.
We've spoken about her before.
Have we? I thought we had.
Yeah, we have. But not on Refinery 29.
What? Yeah, no, I knew I'd read something.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, dope. Look at us.
I know.
Look at regular people we talk about. I don't
regular
know.
Regular journos? I don't know.
Regular journos. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to tweet her and see if she can love us. Okay, so she did an article about a new book that's coming out this week, called It's Not About the Burqa.
Yes!
Oh!
Happy about this story.
Yeah? Have, yeah, you seen this?
Yeah, I've seen this book all over the place.
Yes! Yeah, I'm really excited about, cool, it. Okay. So, blah, blah, blah. Leila talks about the way that, in this article, she talks about the way that Muslim women are presented in the media constantly with an obsession on what they're wearing, a kind of myth, alleged submissiveness, and all the while the media is talking for Muslim women, we don't seem to be able to hear a lot from Muslim women in their own words. And this is why author Maryam Khan decided to edit the first anthology of its kind, It's Not About the Burqa, which is being published this week. It's written by, it's made up of contributions by 17 Muslim women, journalists, playwrights, activists, etc. More, talking frankly and on their own terms, and showing us that they're significantly more multifaceted than we're led to believe. Khan said that she would constantly see Muslim women's identities shaped in a way that wasn't necessarily informed by them. This book centres our narrative on in our own voices. It's so exciting. Mm-hmm. We're going to get it.
Yeah. And we're going to read it, and it's going to be That's What She Read.
Yeah, that's perfect.
For sure.
Okay. Yeah. Khan hopes that the book will spark conversation, seeing each essay as the beginning of a discussion that can lead to a million more. There's also a tendency to say that the fault lies with the religion itself, but Islam, we've talked about this in the podcast on That's What She Read, we talked about how Islam is actually quite a sex positive faith for women, more so than others, within the confines of marriage, but it's one of the only religions that focuses on female pleasure as part of its
doctrine.
Yeah. So there was Prophet Muhammad's female companions who would marry several times because they wanted to have sex, to the rise of halal sex shops, which I didn't heard of.
I haven't either. That's very exciting.
I know. Yeah. Islam has actually for a long time been preaching about women's rights in the bedroom. How many religions can say that?
Mm-hmm.
The Pope is ruining sex for women. For some reason, though, the female sex positivity of the faith is just lost in the media. It's Islamophobia. It's just a complete misrepresentation of and a denial of letting Muslim women have their own voice in this. So this is what this book is going to do. So Leila Hajrani, the author, is also a Muslim woman, talks in the article a bit about her own experience of being Muslim and how there was a shame surrounding sex that she felt was detrimental to her future relationships, her consequent relationships, her subsequent relationships, her relationships.
Yeah. All of those things.
So she talks about how she welcomes the call for Muslim women to start having open conversations that can help us to grow and share our experiences in rays of sunlight as opposed to whispering them in dark corners, because dark corners produce young women whose shame accompanies them to the bedroom. The more we see and hear voices like those in the book, the more we'll realise that there is room for Muslim women to be sex positive and religious. Unlearning is a difficult process, El Wadani, one of the contributors, says, but I'm getting there. In my journey as a sex positive Muslim woman, I'm putting my own pleasure first, away from shame and guilt, and I hope other Muslim women will join me.
That's wonderful.
Yes, it's promises to be a good read.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Look forward to reading it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Right.
You're doing the face that says I've got a heavy one coming.
It is, yeah. When I was researching this, I was like getting visibly angry.
Oh no. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's great.
We'll
see. It's important. Okay. That's the point. So the headline of the article that first sparked a deep dive into the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Nationalist strongmen are bent on controlling women's bodies.
Good start.
By Afua Hirsch for The Guardian.
Okay.
All right. So my timeline isn't the most sensical.
That's all right. We're not here for facts.
So I actually had to do a little bit of background research before I could get into the article properly.
Oh my goodness.
Did you know that every day this year, 4 women have been killed in Brazil?
No.
Yeah, sucks. Quite a lot. And according to the United Nations, Brazil has the highest rate of female homicide, which is actually known as femicide.
Okay.
In countries where it's actually such an epidemic, it's its own crime.
Okay.
So Brazil has the highest rates of femicide in the world.
As in women murdering?
Women being murdered.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, oh.
Yeah. And the thing that distinguishes femicide is it's because it's based on their gender.
Yeah.
and includes LGBTQ plus women, equal rights activists and politicians.
Oh god, okay.
So for example, last year, Marielle Franco, a rising political star and black councilwoman in Rio de Janeiro, was murdered. So that is an example of someone who could have been a shining light in the government.
Mm.
Brazil is one of 15 countries that had to introduce laws against femicide to tackle the epidemic, which was introduced to the country in 2015.
Wait, like specific laws against?
Yeah.
Okay.
So in 2015, they introduced laws with tougher jail sentences and up to 30 years for convicted offenders.
Okay, so it's kind of making it along the hate crime line.
Yeah.
Like murders across hate crime. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, that's how they're, yeah, I don't really know where to go from there.
No, sorry, we're not lawyers.
No. So, let's get back into the article by Ophir Hirsch. So, we've spoken about the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, before, and about how much he is a disgusting creature.
Yeah.
He is a far-right politician as well, if anyone needs a little refresher. And what the article on The Guardian focuses on is reproductive fascism. Have you heard of this term before?
I'm scared of it a lot.
I'm going to get into it.
Okay.
It's two words that should not belong together.
Jesus.
So one of Bolsonaro's early acts in office was to replace the Government Department for Human Rights with a Department for Family Values.
No. Truly horrifying in itself.
In charge of this department is a right-wing evangelical preacher called Damaris Alves, who said she would help low-income women, but she's also anti-abortion.
Right, okay. I'm going to need some...
Yeah.
I'm going to need her to justify how she's helping low-income women then.
Yeah, we'll get into it. So Alves then went on to appoint Sarah Winter to run policy on motherhood.
Right, yep.
And Sarah Winter was formerly a member of feminist group Femen, but now someone who claims Christianity has cured her feminism.
What? No.
I want to cry. I'm so upset.
No.
Yeah, I thought I'd be ready for this, but I'm not.
Brainwashed. Mm. What's happened? That's terrifying. What is happening in that government? Mm. Oh my god.
Yeah, I kind of want to be sick in my mouth, but I'm going to keep going for you guys.
Thank you.
So, in the article, Hirsch draws parallels to other governments bent on controlling women's bodies.
Yeah.
Trump recently appointed Rebecca Clefish, a former TV anchor who believes women should be subservient to their husbands.
Okay, yep.
To the head of the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission.
What?
Yeah. So, you know, it's been it hit 100 years since women's suffrage, which is giving the right to vote to women.
So she's the head of a...
She's the head of overseeing this big event in their history.
Oh no, the unveiling at the event is going to be, we're going back in time.
Yeah.
No.
That's apparently what they want.
Oh my God.
Let's go over to Poland and their family 500 plus measure. Which was a policy introduced by the ruling Law and Justice Party that gives families 500 zlotys, which is equivalent to £100 a month, for each second and subsequent child. I know they do a similar thing in Russia as well. Basically, you're given more money for the more children you have.
And in Germany at one point.
Really? Oh, well, not currently though. And I mean, imagine that was like...
No, that was recent.
Not post-war? Like,
they kept it for a while.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure.
Well, Poland are doing that right now. And Russia are doing that right now. So yeah, basically, women should have lots of kids, apparently. Okay. According to them, that's a good thing.
Okay.
Which is fine for some people.
There's too many on the planet anyway, though.
There's too many people.
Yeah.
Let's go to Hungary. Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, has just declared that women with 4 children or more will be exempt from paying income tax. On what income exactly? When they have 4 children, who's going to have time to go to work?
Mm.
But yeah, and I actually read something where he was like, we want Hungarian children. Like, we want Hungarian, because they in Hungary, they have a big problem with migration rather than immigration, which gets a lot of media attention.
Okay.
And they're basically saying, we need to populate this country or we're not going to exist anymore. Which is just ridiculous. Yeah. Like, fix the other problems. Mm. Why are people leaving your country?
Yeah. Having more babies is not the solution.
Yeah. Let's go back to that interesting phrase, reproductive fascism.
Okay.
The rest of the article, Hirsch does not revisit this point. And I was like, well, what do you mean? What is this exactly?
So they just threw it in at the start and left us to
figure that out.
Fear, like,
which is, I'm very happy that it was put in there because my interest was sparked. I'm not sure if you're aware of this either, but Brazilian law permits abortion in cases of rape and danger to the woman's life. But nothing else.
Right, okay.
So very strict abortion laws.
Mm.
So I found an older article on Open Democracy, which highlighted that even during the Zika virus epidemic, if you remember this, which is approximately from 2015 to 2016, the Brazilian government refused to change the abortion law, despite the fact that the most vulnerable group were pregnant women, and even more so those African Brazilian women in poor communities.
Okay.
So even when faced with a mass epidemic that was targeting people with the least access to abortion, and also the highest risk of contracting the Zika virus and passing it on to their children, there were still
still values are more important than stupid moralistic judgment on abortion comes first.
Yeah.
Cool.
This did not go unnoticed.
No.
I will say that. Lots of different organisations and charities recognise this as a problem and petitioned the Supreme Court to look at this. One such group is the International Women's Health Coalition, who later filed an amicus curiae request.
Yes, I'm familiar.
Yes, so lawful.
Sounds lawy.
Sounds so legally.
Mm-mm.
Yes. Based on reports by the UN Human Rights Council Special Procedures Mandate Holders.
Oh my goodness, just words on words on words.
Which outlined how denial of abortion in the context of Zika amounts to torture and or cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment. Unfortunately, the Brazilian Supreme Court, who are expected to rule on the injunction of this case on December 7th, 2016, didn't, because it was postponed.
Okay.
And has never since been picked up.
Right, okay.
There's no...
Yeah.
I mean, I may be... Please, if you can do better research than I did, but I spent a long time researching and couldn't find any evidence that this ruling, this...
No, it sounds like it would have been...
It went ahead.
Covered in the media if... Yeah, okay.
So I also... In my research found, well, not in my research, my general knowledge, I suppose, that the Brazilian government is quite racist towards those who are not of European descent.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, your African Brazilian population. And the fact that the Zika virus was targeting the African Brazilian population and their offspring, and they didn't do anything about it, kind of makes me think they were attempting to, like,
oh no, that's disgusting.
To reduce that population? Yeah. Mm. That is no article. That is my opinion from what I have found.
Yeah. But the facts were laid out.
Yeah.
And it's... Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
That. Well, yeah. It's not okay, is it?
No.
And to wrap it all up, Damaris Alves, head of the Department of Family Values,
our favourite department.
Yeah. He's now calling for a country with no abortions. That is her goal.
Ugh.
No abortions. Ugh. At all.
That's... Why are people so obsessed with abortion as some kind of display of values and morality? Mm. I really, truly don't understand it. It's so weird. Like, religions... If it's a religious argument, religions have been around long before abortion. And religions have adapted to everything else. Well, not really, but like... But do you know what I mean? Like, can I kindly encourage this Minister for Family Values or whatever, what's she called, what's her title?
I don't.
Well, her, to listen to our last episode about the effects of abortion on families.
Yeah, we should. We should definitely encourage that.
Send it over.
Yeah, I will. Just pop it over on the DM.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's just one reason why my blood was boiling this week.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a blood boiling situation. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have like a blood tingling? No, that sounds weird.
my blood tingling? What is blood tingling, you?
This is like an observation piece. More than I don't know. I'll just say it before I decide what you should feel about it.
Okay.
So this is a completely different tack. This is like ruined all our beautiful segues.
There was no segues.
Well, no, but it did all flow. Up until this point, it was like a river of.
Well, now we're going down a fucking waterfall.
Woo! Okay. Oh my god.
Stick me in a barrel and let's go.
Okay. Hannah's got energy.
I don't know where it's come from. It's probably the bottle of wine.
Okay. Okay. So this is a ITV news story.
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay.
I'm just laughing at my own joke again.
And this is something I was having a conversation with my friend about recently, which is probably why I decided to include it. But it's about the way that autism is often not diagnosed in women.
Okay.
So.
Are you about to talk about the chaser?
No, what's the chaser?
Anne Hegarty.
What?
You're the chase?
Yeah.
On ITV.
Oh, the one that won it all? No.
No. She's one of the chasers on an ITV programme called The Chase.
Okay.
It's called Anne Hegarty.
Okay.
And her nickname is the Governess.
Yeah, yeah.
And she is now like an autism advocate.
Okay, cool.
Especially for the diagnosis in women. Oh, and I thought that might be there.
I mean, you would think that I would have done the research and included that, but clearly. No, this is about some other women who are calling for better diagnosis.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, she has a brilliant name. So the woman speaking in this article, the woman they interview, is called Lily Beer Doblon. Beer. Lily Beer Doblon. Doblon.
You look unsure.
You're focusing on the Doblon. It's the beer. Beer is one of her surnames. Yes,
that's very cool.
That's cool. Okay. Lily Beer Doblon has autism, but she believes there is little understanding of the condition amongst the general public, particularly with regards to autistic women. There are approximately 700,000 adults and children with autism in the UK. However, it is widely perceived to affect men only, and women can struggle to get a diagnosis altogether. Beard Doblin says there is a public perception that those on the spectrum are not good at social interaction, but stresses that this is not always the case. She said, "I struggle with social situations, but most people would say that I'm really good, and some people have said that I'm eloquent and so on, but it takes a lot for me to do this."
Mm.
It moves on to talk about a tattoo artist who I actually found out when I was trying to find her social medias. She was on that Tattoo Fixer program. She was one of the tattoo artists on
there. Right.
She's called Charlotte Davies. And she says her autism affects her in everything she does, but before her diagnosis, one doctor had turned her away when she'd suggested autism. So like she'd gone in and said it herself, and they just told her that she was wrong. Louise Albert from the National Autistic Society Cymru says women with autism often do not display the same markers as males and therefore can find it difficult to be diagnosed. She says, "We know that autism is undiagnosed in women, and there's some really key features as to why that's the case. In females, they'll often give more external social signs that they are fitting in with the social norm, whereas males will show that they're not fitting in and they're more isolated." The National Autistic Society Cymru says a mix of research, clinical practice, and anecdotal reports show that many autistic females often miss out on autism diagnoses or can be misdiagnosed with other conditions. More men and boys are currently diagnosed as autistic than women and girls, The gender ratio is still unclear, but various studies, together with anecdotal evidence, have come up with a men-to-women ratio ranging from 2 to 1 to 16 to 1. And that's it for that, really. But another thing that I found in the when I was looking for the Lily Beard Oblin and Charles Davis on the social medias, Lily Beard Oblin is an incredible artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I found her, I think it was on her Twitter, on her Twitter and her Instagram. She posts art and she's not really got that many followers, but her art is fucking fantastic and I can't wait to share her social media.
Yeah.
And I hope people start seeing that because she's so talented.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting you're picking up on how like women are misdiagnosed with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it's perhaps because, like much in the world, doctors and medical professionals are looking at it from a male perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, let's use the, like, the males.
The male interpretation of what?
The male, I don't know if interpretation is right, but the male presentation.
Yeah, yeah. Like the signifiers of.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Of autism as the gold standard. Mm,
as like what it's supposed to look like in inverted commas.
Yeah. But we can't deny that, that chemistry and hormones,
mm.
and all of these things in genders can be different. And
yeah.
So it's going to have different results. I think it just sparked a memory for me that I was recently reading up on the gender disparity in borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
And it used to be thought that women were 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
But actually, it's as we've got more educated on that, it's 50-50. It's male and females. It was just the fact that doctors were seeing it as a female disorder and therefore not recognising when a male patient has that disorder.
Mm.
Vice versa for your autism. So that's really interesting. I'm really happy that, you know, people are stepping forward. And
yeah, there's a lot of advocacy groups on the social media that I'll be sharing as well, and both these women talk about them on their social medias and stuff, and it's really worth sharing. So
good. Yeah, we'll give them a shout out.
We will.
Look forward to sharing this stuff. I just want to stay in that world.
Yeah.
I don't want to go into this world that I have set up for myself. I was really attracted to the darker stories.
It must have been something, but it's okay. We'll work through it.
Have you heard of the art of the musician Ryan Adams?
Yeah.
Have you heard of him recently?
Ringing alarm bells, but I can't quite.
It should ring alarm bells.
Yeah.
There's a New York Times article by Joe Coscarelli and Milena Rizik. So, to sum up, several women have stepped forward accusing musician Ryan Adams of sexual harassment while promising to kickstart their careers. But their experiences either halted or put them off music entirely.
Okay.
So Ryan Adams, who is 44, has been highly influential.
He's only 44? I thought he was older than that.
It's just been going a while.
Mm.
Yeah. He's been highly influential thanks to his industry connections, 16 albums and 7 Grammy nominations.
Mm.
He's been known to champion female artists in the past, and according to this New York Times article, the public advocacy hides a much darker reality.
Yeah.
So these accusers include a fan and promising bass player who began corresponding with Adams online in 2013 when she was 14 years old.
Mm.
Also musician Phoebe Bridges, who was then 20. Who received promises of career success, but instead ended up in a brief but controlling relationship with Adams.
Oh, God. Okay.
And his ex-wife, Mandy Moore, whose career was put on hold throughout their entire marriage because he was so controlling.
Oh, no. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Is it Mandy Moore that I know Mandy Moore?
You probably will. She starred in This Is Us, if you've ever seen that. It's quite popular.
I think I've seen her in stuff.
Yeah. She's
the, I think,
been acting.
She's the actor.
More recently than she has been making music.
Okay.
So I have a quote from the article.
Mm-hmm.
The music world, in which a culture of late nights and boundary pushing behaviour has been normalised. It hasn't been roiled by the Me Too movement, as other sectors of media and entertainment, but many in the business say that harassment and inequitable treatment of women is pervasive and that the sex, drugs and rock and roll ethos has shielded men from being held to account.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
That is like my favourite quote ever for how the Me Too movement hasn't yet taken hold of the music industry.
Yeah.
Sums it up perfectly. Yeah. Absolutely. One of the journalists, Joe Coscarelli, opened a discussion on Twitter saying, "This, as much as heinous physical abuse, is how men wield their power in the music industry. Let's talk about it." Okay. And there's like a whole big thread of people, some people sharing their stories, you know, some people just commenting and replying. So, you know, go follow him because it's a ride.
I've seen some really good Twitter debates at the moment. Mm-hmm. Like everything I've talked about today had like really good, healthy debate around it on the social medias. And it was really interesting to read. I love it when the comments are as interesting as the articles and the posts.
I think as our life becomes more assimilated with social media, it means that we kind of take intellectual debates there as well. It's not now just like all trying to get laughs and trolling.
I don't know
what people do on there. Trolling. I'm really not that great at the social stuff. As people know, I do work in the music industry, and I have been very, very fortunate not to experience any prejudice or any harassment.
Yeah.
Any real obstacles. I mean, I've worked with some idiots.
Yeah.
You know, people that really did put me off working with them, but not put me off working in the industry entirely.
Yeah.
And I think we're in for a tidal wave of revelations about what actually goes on in the music industry.
What did that for me was the Amy documentary, the Amy Winehouse documentary. Oh, that was the first time that I really thought about what the music industry was like.
And that's horrific. Like,
I feel like I'm the antidote to your heavy news today. I'm quite
It's really perfect.
I'm going to say hesitantly that this is quite a positive one.
Okay.
It's from a website called Global Citizen, which is, I don't really understand what it is because it's not quite a news site. But they post articles that are written by people.
Okay.
So, but there's really good source, but they've got a women's rights section.
All right.
Really good source of news. And this is a story about South Korea written by Sulky Lee. The headline is, "The very good reason South Korean women are giving up makeup and cutting their hair." It's not really a headline, is it?
We've been near this territory.
Yeah.
What was that movement called? But when they were smashing their makeup,
it was Escape the Corset or something.
Yeah.
I will talk about it in a second. It's another wave in South Korea of women pushing back against beauty standards, and it's continuing. These waves keep coming.
Good.
So this is the latest.
Love a wave machine. So keep it coming.
Exactly. I just keep thinking of like Glossop swimming pool now, and like
I keep thinking parties. Of every holiday anywhere I've been with a wave machine.
I found them terrifying. I hated them. I just thought I was gonna drown. I think I was just always too little when I was in them, and I was probably was drowning.
Could have been.
Maybe. Okay. So this article interviews a South Korean university student called Yim Ji Soo. And it says she talks about how she used to sacrifice up to 2 hours of sleep each morning for her laborious makeup routine.
2 hours?
Yeah, I know.
Fuck.
I know. I think I would do 25 minutes. I think that's mine.
For
daytime. I can spend hours if I'm going out because I fucking love eyeshadow. But in a normal day, 25 minutes.
Okay. I have no idea. I can time myself.
But about 6 months ago, Yim Ji-soo joined a growing band of young women who have given up makeup and cut their hair short to rebel against long-held ideals of beauty. The article said they claim to have been subjected to in a male-dominated South Korea, but I'm going to go ahead and say that they have been subjected to in male-dominated South Korea. I don't think it's a claim. I think it's pretty much a fact. The debate that's been happening in South Korea, which is described as a beauty-obsessed nation, has forced some brands to rethink their marketing strategies to cater to the growing movement. And that is a nice bit of progress right there.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yim, the student, she's a student in Korean literature, said, "We are not dolls, we are human beings. By escaping this corset, I feel like I am myself again." Adding that a number of students at her campus have also joined the movement. For the interview, she was barefaced and sporting a buzz cut, and that seems to be the signature haircut of the trend, which, look, I think a buzz cut looks so fucking cool, but I'm still not convinced I can pull it off.
It really depends on your head.
Yeah.
Like, and you only know once you've done it.
Exactly.
And then you've done it. I'm not convinced I have the right head shape.
There isn't a right head shape. Yeah, really. There is. You can do what you want.
I was freaking suctioned out as a baby. I had like a weird start.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean your head shape is wrong.
It means it probably doesn't look right with a buzz cut. Also, right? I'm blonde, so I would look straight up bald.
Yeah.
Although there's nothing wrong with that. Bald people are beautiful. I'm sorry. I should not impart my own insecurities onto others.
I think all head shapes could have a buzz cut, but not mine. South Korea's, you'll have heard of K-beauty.
Yes, I have.
Like,
big mainstream beauty brand.
Just K-beauty is in Korean beauty. The lengths that South Korean women go to.
Okay.
And North Korean as well, potentially, but we don't know.
I doubt it, because they don't have access.
No, but they have like 11-step beauty regimes, and we talked about, you probably told me about this last time, and I'm just saying it back to you. But like the super intense beauty regimes that had become part of South Korean culture.
As well as their plastic surgery.
And the plastic surgery, yeah. Like, it's a thing we're a bit obsessed with in the UK as well. Like, beauty websites have sections called K-beauty now. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I keep saying K.
K.
When you say Korea. K-beauty, and yeah. I'm like, ah.
So apparently South Korea has become one of the world's top 10 beauty markets, with many women taking it to the extreme of plastic surgery to reach uniform beauty standards. I think you were telling me last time about the adverts for plastic surgery just like on public transport everywhere.
Mm-hmm. They have a street in Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
By street, I mean it's like freaking Wall Street.
Yeah.
For plastic surgery. And it's like these huge skyscrapers and like gold like plaques outside and everything's like it's
terrifying.
Like you just walk down there like you're out shopping and you go and buy yourself a nose job.
Ugh, it's terrifying. And they all
have a, for women especially, a standard face shape that they're after.
Yeah.
And that's what a plastic surgeon will do time and time again just on like very young women.
Yeah. So alongside this, it's also a very socially conservative country, and it has one of the worst gender wage gaps among developed nations, developed inverted commas, and is ranked 115 out of 149 countries in the World Economic Forum's 2018 Global Gender Gap Report. So that's not great.
No.
Against this economic backdrop, discontent among women about society's patriarchal aspects has been slowly growing. Doesn't even sound slowly to me at this point. It's been, what, the space of a year that there have been these three big waves, pushbacks against beauty standards. And it's not a half arse.
No.
For women to just completely stop wearing makeup and shave their heads, that's not like a middle, that's not hedging your bets, is it? That's like, I'm all in on this.
I think in extreme cases, sometimes you have to go to the other extreme to make your point, to make your voice heard. Mm.
Because if you think about all the positive body positivity movements we have in the UK and the US, it's not to this extent. So there was the smashing the makeup thing that you told me about. There was also this...
Did I tell you that, or did you tell me?
I don't know, but we talked about it on the podcast. It happened.
I feel like it might have been you.
I thought it was you.
I don't know.
I do know a lot about this somehow, so yeah. I think it's one of us. But
oh, cool.
It doesn't
okay.
matter at this point.
It really doesn't.
My knowledge is your knowledge. there was also last year a big street protest, tens of thousands of women taken to the streets against the spy camera porn phenomenon, which I had no idea about, where victims were being filmed illicitly when changing or having sex.
No.
Uh-huh.
Where are the spy cameras? Where are they at?
I think, is this another element of the fact that a lot of South Korean couples have sex in public places? Not in public places, in like they have special hotels. Where
like love hotels.
Love hotels, yeah.
Perhaps.
I'm sure I might be grossly conflating things, but I'm fairly sure that that was a South Korean phenomenon. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if it was part of that, but I might have made that up. So.
I mean, love hotels are something that exists the world over.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but I've definitely seen, I do love a documentary, and I've definitely seen them as an aspect of South Korean culture before.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't know that had happened, and that's fucking grim. But this was around the same time as the Escape the Corset movement, which is what one of us was talking about, posting images of people destroying their makeup. In my notes, I put in brackets, didn't you talk about this? To say to you.
I don't know. I honestly think it was
you. I thought it was you. Okay.
Anywho.
But anyway, around this time, that time, YouTube star Lena Bae, who used to offer makeup tutorials on YouTube, in a viral video revealed the dark side of the rigid beauty standards and the ridicule that she'd had to suffer. In her video, which has attracted nearly 7 million views, Bae said, some viewers told her, I would kill myself if I were you, and I didn't know a pig can make up. So she said, many women were so insecure about their own appearances that they would have to put on makeup even for a short trip to nearby supermarkets. She said, wiping away her makeup in the video, I am not pretty, but it's fine. I will not be able to wear this corset forever. That's crazy from, if you just think about the popularity of beauty bloggers at the moment, and beauty vloggers, that's really powerful for a beauty blogger to push back like that. I like that a lot.
I do. I remember we had over in the UK the no makeup or no naked makes, naked face.
Naked selfie challenge. No.
Maybe for you.
That was just my personal challenge.
2K18, no makeup selfie. Here we go.
No makeup selfie.
Yeah, like no makeup selfie or naked face selfie.
So, despite this growing movement in South Korea, analysts said the K-beauty sector is unlikely to be affected. And data from Mintel, big international data collecting thingy that I read about before and I've now forgotten about. Let's just say data.
Yep.
The data.
Yep.
The data showed. It is expected to reach a retail market value of $11.4 billion in 2019, ugh, from $10.7 billion in 2018. So it's actually growing as a sector.
That's probably because of the global interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, carry on.
So, despite the fact that the movements we've talked about, the what do they call it? Shed the corset.
Oh, escape.
Escape the corset. Right, escape the corset.
Shed your skin.
Become a snake. The malting movement.
Oh my god, can I be part of the malting movement, creepy, please? You haven't seen my coat, mate. I'm already part of it.
So, a senior beauty analyst at Mintel in Seoul, Hu Jun Lee, said that the movement, the Escape the Corset movement, etc., these movements that are emerging in South Korea's younger generations today are trends that have not yet reached the mainstream public. But he also warns beauty brands not to take the trend lightly. Some companies have already begun responding to the growing movement by shifting away from the existing rigid beauty standards to emphasize minimalism with all-in-one beauty products that simplify skincare routines, which is a bit of a, like, tangential way towards a goal. Like, it's still pushing beauty products, and I don't really...
I mean, get away from it with your all-in-one. All-in-one shampoo conditioner, for example, does not work. No. I don't need, like, an all-in-one mascara, foundation, lipstick.
Oh my god, if someone could invent that. Jesus Christ. Now that would be witchcraft. So, blah, blah, blah. So you've got this, but all the same, it's a response to the movement.
Yes.
They are.
Or are they trying to capitalize on a new generation? Response in
it's all about capital, it's all about money, but it's still responding to
Yeah, well, capitalism and democracy are best buds, so you can't have one without the other.
Interesting. That sounds like an A-level politics essay to me. Liberal democracy is a contradiction in terms. Discuss. I did that a few times. Anyway, popular Korean cosmetic brand Misha, meanwhile, has featured a short-haired female model in one of its latest commercials, and other local brands like Laka are doing the same. It's a big deal. Like, it says they featured a short-haired female model, and that's like, okay, big whoop, you did one female model, but it is quite a big deal in South Korea, it would seem. Supporters of these movements have said that giving up makeup is only the start of a bigger push to greater gender equality, as South Korean women confront daily sexism. It's about women's choice, said Shin Ji-yi, a 28-year-old politician who stole headlines last year when she ran for the post of Seoul mayor, but lost. She said the movement is about changing our everyday culture, starting with makeup and moving to bigger things, I think. That's the idea. But campaigner Heather Barr, I don't know who this campaigner Heather Barr is, because I don't know where she gets to say anything, but it's included in the article, so I'm assuming she is important somehow.
Okay.
But yeah, she said it would be a long haul for feminists in South Korea to achieve greater women's rights, including introducing stronger legislation against abuse and sexual harassment. It will take a sustained effort, but they show no signs of giving up. Okay, I just found out why she's she's important. She's real important.
Oh yeah? Oh yeah? She's not just some person in an article.
Oh my god, I'm such a twat. Said the senior women's rights researcher at Global Watchdog Human Rights Watch.
Oh yeah, kind of important. Yeah, that's a big.
Yeah, okay, you can ignore
it's
me.
It's a big thing. Yeah, yeah. Cool.
But yeah, anyway.
Well, cool, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm glad we got there in the end.
I know, okay.
Have we done all the news?
We have done all of it. There is no more news.
All for her.
Yes.
Are you happy I said
it? Yes, I am.
Every time I read Badass Woman from History Now, or the abbreviated version.
Well, it's really long to type out.
Hear ball for her. So you've won.
Yes, I win. It doesn't have to be like a... I'm not expecting it to be like famous. It's not going to be a hashtag or anything.
Ball for her.
It's just for ease. It's such a long thing to say and type.
I get you.
Okay.
Yeah. So you may have heard of this episode's Badass Woman from History simply because of your academic background.
Interesting. Okay.
But I hadn't heard of her until I picked up a book.
It's horrible.
Recently.
It's horrible, isn't it?
It was such a strain. Audre Lorde?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You've probably heard
but
of
I don't
her.
Know I know the name and I might pick up some things, but I don't know the story.
Okay. Well, let's get into it. And this ties in really well with our earlier news pieces.
I hope I didn't shit on it.
You didn't at all. Okay. You added flavour.
Oh, all about that healthy debate.
Flavour flip. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and say Audre Lorde is the embodiment of intersectional feminism.
What?
Yeah. And even before the term intersectionality was coined.
Yeah.
So we kind of got into this earlier about the big question, what is intersectional feminism?
Mm-hmm.
Since I did the research, I'm going to say my bit.
Yeah.
So you also said earlier, intersectionality is a term that was coined by American professor Kimberly Crenshaw
mm-hmm.
in 1989. The concept had already existed, but she put a name to it.
Yeah.
And the textbook definition states, the view that women experience oppression in varying configurations and in varying degrees of intensity. Cultural patterns of oppression are not only interrelated, but are bound together and influenced by the intersectional systems of society. Examples of this include race, gender, class, ability, and ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, certain groups of women have multi-layered facets in life, and there is a no one-size-fits-all type of feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is our starting point.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's go back to the start of Audre Lorde's life. Audre was born in New York City to Caribbean immigrants. Her father, Frederick Byron Lorde, from Barbados, and her mother, Linda Gertrude Belmar Lorde, was Grenadian from the island of Kiriakou They decided to settle in Harlem with the idea that they'd go to America, make a load of money, and go back to Granada with the family. This was especially important to Audrey's mother, who considered Granada to be their true home.
I've just realised who this is now.
Yeah?
Yeah. Carry on.
I thought you'd know who this was, but still, badass woman, if there ever was one. So while her father struggled to find work as a visibly black immigrant, her mother was able to find work as a cleaner passing as Spanish. Her mother's sense of racial superiority was something founded in the class system in Granada, and something she was very outspoken about within the home. This made Audrey feel like an outcast, as she, like her father, was visibly darker.
Oh.
As a child, she was also nearsighted and classed as legally blind, had a stutter, and had to wear corrective shoes.
Oh.
I know, poor baby. Apparently, her older sisters, Phyllis and Helen, were quite jealous of Audrey for all this extra attention.
They want corrective shoes.
As well as being the baby of the family. So she was not only the youngest, but then she had all this extra attention. As an older sibling, I feel. But like, don't be so jealous. It's fine.
Yeah, don't be jealous of someone's nearsightedness.
No.
For God's sake.
So ridiculous. So Audrey was educated at Catholic grammar schools, where she faced patronising racism at St. Mark's School and downright hostile racism at St. Catherine's School. Although at Hunter High School, she found a lifeline in a sisterhood of rebels who were also poets.
Oh, poetry.
Brings us together. Of her poetic beginnings, Audrey commented in Black Women's Writers, "I used to speak in poetry. I would read poems and I would memorise them. People would say, 'Well, what do you think, Audrey? What happened to you yesterday?' And I would recite a poem, and somewhere in that poem would be a line or a feeling I would be sharing. In other words, I literally communicated through poetry, and when I couldn't find the poems to express the things I was feeling, that's what started me writing poetry, and that was when I was 12 or 13. What the hell?
I know.
Such an overachiever.
I know. I just remembered that I was talking to a friend on my course, and she was like, "Did you know who Audre Lorde is?" And I was like, the poet. No, we didn't really know much about her. And then she was like, "Yeah, I kept seeing her poems like as like Instagram quotes, and it would say Lorde at the bottom. And I kept thinking it was Lorde the singer, and I was like, I didn't think she was, I really didn't think she was that profound, but I've been really respecting Lorde ever since, and I've only just realised that it's not that Lorde."
I love that so much.
It killed me. I did the same for a bit. I was like, Lorde is not that deep, is she?
Wow.
Yeah.
This Lorde is. As we're going to continue to find out. Audrey published her first poem in 17 magazine, which is still going, I think.
Oh my God.
After her school's literary journal rejected it for being inappropriate.
Ooh, I want to read me some of that.
I did actually Google Audre Lorde's first poem and I couldn't find it. So, I don't know.
That sounds like a Reddit find. But you'd need to go, that would be in the deep.
Have to go deep.
Yeah, go deep.
So after graduating from high school, Audrey attended Hunter College from 1954 to 1959, graduating with a bachelor's degree. While studying library science, Lorde supported herself working various odd jobs. Factory worker, ghostwriter, social worker, x-ray technician, medical clerk, and, my favourite, arts and crafts supervisor.
These are not odd jobs. Odd jobs are where you walk dogs and clean people's cars. Like, this is just...
jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of them.
Lots of jobs.
In 1954, she spent a pivotal year as a student at the National University of Mexico, a period described by Lorde as a time of affirmation and renewal because she confirmed her identity on personal and artistic levels as a lesbian and a poet. On her return to New York, Lorde went to college, worked as a librarian, continued writing, and became an active participant in the gay culture of Greenwich Village. Lorde furthered her education at Columbia University, earning a master's degree in library science in 1961. During this time, she also worked as a librarian at Mount Vernon Public Library and married his curveball, attorney Edward Ashley Rollins.
That sounds something went wrong.
So it wasn't an easy decision for her to marry a man.
No.
Nevertheless, a white man.
Mm.
And she was concerned about how this would infringe on her identity as a black lesbian.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was concerned about how marrying a man would infringe on your identity as a lesbian. I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah. And apparently Rollins, so the man she wanted to marry, while he didn't openly identify as homosexual, he had mostly had relationships with men prior to meeting Audre Lorde. So the suggestion is that they both wanted kids.
Oh.
So they got married and had kids.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's one way to do it.
Yeah. You know.
When, and also, what year is this? We're still talking, right?
This is 1960s.
Oh.
Very early 1960s.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And throughout their marriage, they both had relationships with other people. So further supporting speculation that they got married to have kids.
Mm.
And they later divorced in 1970 after having two children, Elizabeth and Jonathan.
They got what they came for.
Yeah. I mean, they put in the time.
Yeah.
Not get it wrong.
No, yeah.
It's longer than most marriages these days. Throughout the 1960s, Audre Lorde's poetry was published regularly. In Langston Hughes' 1962 New Negro Poets, in several foreign anthologies, and in black literary magazines. During this time, she was politically active in the civil rights, anti-war, and feminist movements.
Cool.
Yeah. Having it all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A turning point came for Audrey in the year 1968. She received a National Endowment for the Arts grant. And in spring of 1968, she became poet-in-residence at Tougaloo College, a small historically black institution in Mississippi. Her experience as both teacher and writer of poetry virtually changed Audrey's life.
Oh my god. Love that.
So yeah, this is really where it starts to pick up in terms of her poetry. Her early collections include The First Cities, published in 1968, Cables to Rage in 1970, and From a Land Where Other People Live in 1972, which was nominated for a National Book Award. Later works include probably one of her most famous later works that people have heard of is The Black Unicorn,
mm-hmm.
published in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
Poet Adrienne Rich said of the Black Unicorn that Lorde writes as a black woman, a mother, a daughter, a lesbian, a feminist, a visionary. Poems of elemental wildness and healing, nightmare and lucidity.
Okay, just an
average
review.
How intersectional is that though? Yeah. We're going to talk about like what is intersectional. Like, just go and read some Audre Lorde and you will get it. Speaking about her own poetry, Audrey said, "I have a duty to speak the truth as I see it and to share not just my triumphs, not just the things that felt good, but the pain, the intense, often unmitigating pain."
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things that I love about Audre Lorde, is she's so complicated.
Yeah.
And she's not someone that it was easy to research.
No.
And I'm giving you a snapshot
of
her.
Yeah, of course, yeah. As that is all we can do.
It is, yeah. In the pod life.
We are but humble podcast researchers.
Much of the inspiration for her poetry came from her journals as well, her personal journal. And one of her most famous poems is called Power.
Mm-hmm.
A poem about the police shooting of a 10-year-old black child.
Oh, God.
And so she discussed the feelings when she learned that the officer involved had been acquitted. So Audre Lorde says, "A kind of fury rose up in me. The sky turned red. I felt so sick. I felt as if I would drive this car into a wall, into the next person I saw. So I pulled over. I took out my journal just to air some of my fury, to get it out of my fingertips. Those expressed feelings are that poem."
That's incredible to have that mastery of your own emotions to be able to channel it so directly.
Mm. that's it, really. Yeah. Can't really add to
that. That's some serious emotional intelligence to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And directly link the catharsis of writing, like, in your intense rage. Like, yeah.
And to put that to paper. Mm. And if you want to go and read Power, along with a handful of other poems, you can find them for free on the Poetry Foundation.
Okay.
You know, I went on there, I read a few, and I was like, which one can I read out on the podcast? I was like, I can't do justice to any of these. So go on there and read it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. Stepping back for a moment from her poetry. In 1972, Lorde met her long-term partner, Francis Clayton, a professor of psychology, and they were together until 1986. Not long after that, she started a relationship with feminist Dr. Gloria Joseph, who was Lorde's partner for the last 6 years of her life, and they resided together on Joseph's native land of Saint Croix in the Caribbean.
Ooh.
Together, they founded several organisations, such as the Che Lumumba School for Truth, Women's Coalition of Saint Croix, US Virgin Islands, Sisterhood in Support of Sisters in South Africa, and Doc Lock Apiary.
Okay, just a few.
Yeah, busy last 6 years.
Fuck, yeah.
As we discussed before, she said she identified as a lesbian throughout her entire life. The majority of her relationships were with women. So, speaking on her sexuality, Lorde says, "My sexuality is part and parcel of who I am, and my poetry comes from the intersection of me and my world."
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Perfect. Yeah. She also supported women of colour in writing, as you can imagine, you know, from several of those organisations, but she also was a co-founder of Kitchen Table, the first publishing house in the US for women of colour.
Oh my god. That's a pretty dope claim, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That is. Yeah, to be the first at something is always good. Her work in all of the areas of her life, because there was a lot, continued until she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1978 and underwent a mastectomy. 6 years later, she was diagnosed with liver cancer. After her diagnosis, she wrote the cancer journals, which won the American Library Association Gay Caucus Book of the Year Award in 1981. I love it. Yeah. I love that whole niche. Yeah. She was featured as a subject of a documentary called A Litany for Survival, The Life and Work of Audre Lorde.
Okay,
A Litany for Survival is one of her poems as well.
Okay.
That's where they got it from. They didn't come up with that shit. No. Which shows the author, poet, human rights activist, feminist, lesbian, teacher, and survivor as a crusader against bigotry.
Oh, crusader. Love that word.
Yeah. She's quoted as saying, "What I leave behind has a life of its own. I've said this about poetry. I've said it about children. Well, in a sense, I'm saying it about the very artifact of who I have been."
Okay. Artifact.
And from 1991 until her death, she was the New York State Poet Laureate. Doesn't stop for her, does it? Not even like any point. When designating her as such, the then governor Mario Cuomo said of Lorde, "Her imagination is charged by a sharp sense of racial injustice and cruelty, of sexual prejudice. She cries out against it as the voice of indignant humanity. Audre Lorde is the voice of the eloquent outsider who speaks in a language that can teach and touch people everywhere."
Oh, eloquent outsider.
I love that. Hell. I know. As a headline.
Yeah.
As a freaking Twitter bio.
Oh my god.
Eloquent outsider.
Someone's gonna pick that up. Someone must have picked that up.
In 1992, we're still going.
Yeah.
Into the future.
as it tends to.
She received the Bill Whitehead Award for Lifetime Achievement from Publishing Triangle. In 2001, Publishing Triangle instituted the Audre Lorde Award to honour works of lesbian poetry.
Okay. Audre Lorde Award.
Audre Lorde Award.
I love that.
So catchy.
And it's for poets.
So sadly, Audre Lorde died of liver cancer at the age of 58 on November 17th, 1992. And at the time, she'd been living with Gloria Joseph. In an African naming ceremony before her death, she took the name Gamba Adisa, which means warrior, she who makes her meaning known.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Such a good name.
Naming ceremony. Fucking hell.
I know. This actually isn't in my notes, but from other research, she retraced her roots to Africa and a later stage in her life. And this was part of that.
Okay.
Like, you know, like aligning her identity with who she is, with also her African heritage.
Yeah.
And just another way why she is so fucking awesome and encompasses so many identities just like seamlessly.
Yeah.
Brings me to sort of my closing points, that Audre Lorde is undoubtedly a pioneer of intersectional feminism. She's a critic of homogenized womanism and an icon for black lesbians everywhere.
And everyone else.
True, but especially, yeah, yeah. You know, you've got, what's that phrase everyone keeps running back to? You've got to
see it to be it.
See it to be it.
Yeah.
It's a bit flippant and twittery, but that's the world we're in.
Yeah.
And as a final roundup, Scottish poet laureate, which is also a macaw, is the actual word for a Scottish poet laureate.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's only been three of them so far.
Yeah. Isn't that the current Jackie Kay?
Jackie Kay.
I know she didn't really know her.
Yeah.
She teaches at Manchester.
Does she? No fucking way.
I studied her recently.
Have you been, like, in a room with her?
I could be, if I chose to be.
Oh.
She's, like, I've walked up past her in the corridor.
That's so crazy!
She's sick.
I'm so
I know. I was so excited when you were saying that, then. Go on.
Scottish poet laureate, Jackie Kay, said that when she first read The Black Unicorn, it was like finding a friend. Her work told me I was not alone.
You should read Jackie Kay. She's fucking sick.
I have read some Jackie Kay.
Have you read the adoption papers?
No.
Literally got it right here. You can take that with you.
Thanks.
I just pulled a book off the bookshelf. I'm such an intellectual.
I got a book.
Oh, she's brilliant, Jackie Kay. Fucking love her.
Some Jackie Kay. Yeah. Back in the day of when I was being all academic.
Mm-hmm.
Not now. I'm just like melting my brain.
I am, and I'm still an academic, so that's fine.
So I'm going to shout out some sources,
mm-hmm.
Which was a book called Modern Women, 52 Pioneers by Kira Cochrane, biography.com, solid.
Yeah, I've used that before, I'm sure.
And the Poetry Foundation.
Okay. Cool. Thank you, Hannah.
That's all.
That was good. It's good to know the story of someone I feel like I should know the story of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't. And I think that's simply because you've been exposed to that more than maybe some other people.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, given my line of study.
Yeah, to be fair.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'm so glad I got to give you extra reading.
Yeah! it's a little book.
It is.
It's not too much.
No, and it's really fucking good.
Good. Okay.
Yes. I'm excited. Okay.
This episode song is by a Leeds-based band called Polo.
Okay.
And the song's called On My End.
Yes.
The trio is fronted by a fabulous woman called Kat.
Mm-hmm.
And she says of the song, "It's basically me putting my fingers in my ears to all the external nags and pressures to do things a certain way. It's a bit cheeky and to be taken with a pinch of sarcasm."
Ooh. I'm intrigued. I can't wait to hear that.
We'll be putting that out at the end of the show. Do you want to plug our socials before we do that?
I think that's a good idea. Please do follow us on the social medias. We are on Twitter at That's What She Pod. We are on Instagram, That's What She Said _ podcast. And we're on Facebook, That's What She Said Podcast. It couldn't be the same for all of them. Please don't hate me. I tried my best.
We did try.
And as ever, you can email us your thoughts. You can listen us your thoughts. Oh, let me see.
That's new.
You can email us your thoughts on what we had to say. There was quite a lot of big issues we talked about today. And
sure.
We are, of course, open to being corrected, to discussing things further. So please do email us at thatswhatshesaidlisteners@gmail.com.
We're also really happy to receive direct messages.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
For any of the socials.
We're all over the socials, like our personal ones and the podcast ones. So anything you want to say, you can say it, even if it's just a sentence or a link.
Or say hi.
Or just hi.
Hi. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we'll see us out with the song that you will say the name of again.
On My End by Polo.
Okay, thank you everybody,
see you next time.
Bye.
They say, why you couldn't